this having?
No. It's Iowa.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason, and I'm glad you joined me today. And from my understanding, we may have a whole bunch of new people that are listening in from stations in the Midwest. Flint Saginaw, AM WSNL at AM 600, WLCM AM 1390 in Lansing, Michigan, and Utica, New York, WJIV 99.1 FM. Glad to have you all on board. And this is the Marketplace of Ideas, where issues of philosophy and religion are discussed in the open forum of talk radio. That's why the show is called Stand to Reason. I think Christianity is worth thinking about, and that's what we do here every Sunday, 3 until 5. Now, that would be West Coast time, so if you're in the Midwest somewhere, you're going to have to make your own adjustments with the time schedule there. Also, those of you who are listening on podcasts, which are legion actually now, you need to know the time. So if you call in during the live show, you can do that during the live show, 3 o'clock to 5 o'clock here on the West Coast, Los Angeles time. My number, 1-800-227-5278, and if you're in the 714 area code, that's local to me, 754-4150. 1-800-227-5278 or 714-754-4150. I'll be getting to your call shortly here. A couple of things that have come to mind that I want to kick off with here, and that is I just heard this morning in church as our pastor was using this as an illustration. I don't watch TV hardly at all, although, and maybe I'll say something more about this later, I will be watching tonight in the Ken Burns kickoff of his new documentary on World War II, simply entitled The War. We don't watch much TV at our home, but we do watch some things, and we're very careful about how we spend our time there in front of what my dad used to call the boob tube. In any event, I didn't catch the Emmys because I care nothing for them. Sometimes the Oscars could be fun, but usually they're kind of a bore too. But I do watch movies, and so I, you know, have a vested interest in some degree in those kinds of things. But in the TV awards, the Emmys, I have none. But apparently, there was an Emmy Award winner. Her name's Catherine Griffin. Is that right? Is it Catherine Griffin? Yeah. Kathy? Kathy Griffin? See, I don't even know who these people are, but she won an Emmy and created quite a stir, at least with evangelicals and theists in general, I guess, because of something she said when she received her Emmy. And it came up here during church, and that's how I happen to know about this. Apparently, the enforcer at Stand to Reason has blogged on this, and so do you go. If you go to str.org, you can see where the enforcer weighed in. What day was that you you did that? On Thursday, Tuesday, maybe last week sometime, she offered some thoughts on it, which it turns out were, from what I heard from her, similar to the reaction that I had when I heard what Kathy Griffin said. Now, as you may know, people use the receiving of awards and TV Emmys or Oscars as an opportunity to express their views and campaign about something broadly political, and religious would be kind of in that category. In other words, they give opinions about things to have an impact with the viewers that really have little to do with the reason they're standing on stage at that moment. And this has been going on for a long time. And many people who are followers of Christ of some stripe will mention God or Jesus in their thanks for the award that they've earned. And I don't really have a problem with that. I certainly applaud the sentiment. I'm not sure it's always wise for followers of Jesus Christ to make displays like that, because I don't know that they're productive, whether they do good or do harm. It's a separate topic, and I have to think about that a little bit more. But to me, it's not enough that they just have the best intentions. Let's put it that way. But the folks do that, all right? And others who are not followers of Jesus are aware of this, and indeed this was Kathy Griffin's awareness, and she wanted to say something about that. And so I guess her comment was something to the order of, and I'm not quoting her exactly, I'm getting this secondhand, but many of you saw this apparently, so you know what she said. She said something like, people come up here and thank Jesus at times like this. Well, I want you to know that Jesus had nothing to do with this. And then I guess she raised her award skyward and taunting God, and then said something to God that was bleeped out, apparently. In other words, she's using some obscenity in her address of the God she doesn't believe in. She's an atheist, apparently. And then said something to the effect of, "This award is my God now." As she holds this idol up. Now, it wasn't an Oscar. It was an Emmy. I don't know. I don't even know what they look like. I think they're some kind of like a modern art type sculpture or something or other. But the Oscar, there's an image, you know, a graven image. So it's much more dramatic. But in any event, it was enough to offend a lot of Christians. Now, I just from my perspective, let me just offer this. This kind of stuff doesn't really bother me that much. And I know some people were thinking, oh, God would strike her down for this display of arrogance and hostility towards him, you know, and don't taunt God like that. You never know when a bolt of lightning will come through. Well, when was the last time that happened? And I actually don't like it when Christians make comments like that. I don't think it's helpful. And I'll tell you the reason why. God should strike us down for all kinds of things, it seems to me. And what Kathy Griffin said would be the least of them. Oh, I mean, I know it's kind of an in-your-face kind of thing, and if somebody thumped you on the chest, you'd get mad. But I don't know that God gets mad at things like that. I think God is angry about the way people live their lives, and his justice is provoked. And there will be a time when justice will be done. As one person put it, there is a justice and someday they shall feel it. But, you know, there's no cause for us to take joy in that, because if justice were actually done with regards to us individually, we'd feel it too. In other words, there's a lot of things that God could strike us down for. And also when we talk about God getting mad and striking someone down for raising their fist against them. I mean, what kind of picture of God does this kind of paint for people? That it would be that kind of thing that would tick him off. Yes, as I mentioned a moment ago, he does have his kind of persistent anger and hostility towards sin. And this is informed by his justice. But it isn't like God has a temper. He has a bad hair day, and so somebody strikes him wrong, and he strikes them down. It almost makes God out to be a kind of capricious being, easily annoyed, and if you annoy him, look out, because he might lose his temper, and you'll be fried. No, I don't think that's the way God is, and so I don't make reference to him in these ways. Look out, he might strike you down. I imagine if he was going to strike people down, if that was the way he was going to exhibit his justice, there would be a lot of people struck down on a regular basis. Because the fact is, people are shaking their fists at God every minute of every day in the way they live their lives. God doesn't have a short temper. Indeed, he's long-suffering. And frankly, I don't expect anybody who has not bent the knee to their sovereign to act any differently. And sometimes I think as followers of Christ, we get our nose out of joint when we see displays like this. And, you know, we shake our heads and we think, look what the world's coming to. Well, the world has always been like this in a certain sense. Now, there is a difference that I do want to speak to, but it's nothing of the kind we've just been talking about. I think there's a difference in that it strikes me as unusual in a certain way that a person like this could feel completely comfortable in making such a statement publicly, not because God's offended, because as I said, I don't think God's offended anymore by that gesture in public by Kathy Griffin as he is by anything else in her life, or ours for that matter. But I think it's what this tells us about her attitude towards other people. Now, I have often made the observation, though I haven't stated it quite like this, that tolerance is a one-way street in our culture. That tolerance is a huge public virtue, that is a certain understanding of tolerance. I would call it a postmodern understanding of tolerance, not a classical understanding of tolerance, a view that all views are equally valid and we must never do anything to ever offend anyone. Now, of course, this only applies to politically correct issues. And so people who have views that are politically correct and deeply offensive to the rest of culture must be allowed to state their views, and the rest of us are to be tolerant to that. We can't object. We can't be offended. We've got to not only applaud the liberty to speak such things, but we have to, in some measure, even applaud the thing, or else we're culpable. So it's not just enough to say live and let live with regards to homosexuality. If we suggest that homosexuality is somehow morally suspect, then we ourselves are morally suspect. But that's not a two-way street. And what happened at the Emmys is a good example of that. What if I were receiving an Emmy and I happened to see Kathy Griffin in the crowd and I said, thank you for your vote. Now I've received this Emmy. I like your vote of confidence. I appreciate. And by the way, Kathy Griffin has the ugliest, fattest, stupidest looking kid I have ever seen. Now, this would be odd if somebody were to say that, wouldn't it? And it would be completely and universally censured. And though some people might say, well, he has the right to say whatever he wants, but that doesn't mean it's right for him to say whatever he wants. That kind of statement was rude. It was abusive. It was unkind. In other words, they would feel completely justified in condemning me for using my liberty to offend a person. How many people do you think were deeply offended when the one they loved the most in all the world, Jesus Christ, was put up to public ridicule? Millions were deeply offended at that. Their feelings were hurt because this woman treated someone that they love and hold dear as an object of ridicule. No, I'm not saying she didn't have the right to say it. I'm not talking about what one has the right that is liberty to do. I'm talking about what is reasonable, sound, virtuous, kind, thoughtful to do. And as I pointed out, if somebody would have done the same kind of thing with a different subject, her own child maybe, the offense would have been obvious, but it seems like open season on someone like Jesus Christ, regardless how other people feel about him. The comment that the enforcer made in her, that would be Linda Penner, in her commentary on the blog, was a comment about self-censorship with decency. I think that's a good way of putting it. Self-censorship with decency. It's not enough to say, well, I have a right to say whatever I want. After all, there is free speech. That's not the issue at all. The issue is, what is the right way to use such a freedom? Is it appropriate to use your freedom simply to cause offense? Now, in most circumstances, we'd say no. But in some circumstances, it seems to be quite okay for millions of people to be offended for no good purpose when the issue is religion, especially, I shouldn't say especially, when the issue is in particularly Christian religion. Now, again, I'm not the kind of guy who's saying lions and tigers and bears, oh my, they're doing nasty things, they're talking against us. And no, this is what I expect, but I'm just pointing out the inconsistency. Again, in one sense, I expect no less in terms of rebellion against God, and this is why Paul says in 1 Corinthians 5, we don't judge those outside of the church. We don't expect non-Christians to live like Christians. We shouldn't be horrified when they don't. What we should be is horrified when Christians don't live like Christians and direct our gaze more inward amongst our own and see and level the appropriate judgment there. In fact, that's Paul's point in 1 Corinthians 5. Incidentally, kind of along the same line, did I hear that Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who is the president of Iran, has responded to an invitation by Columbia University, an Ivy League school, to address the school in their distinguished lecture series? Again, this is another example about how political correctness, openness, tolerance only goes one direction. I wonder if, now Jerry Falwell is dead, but he still is an icon, and he's useful for my illustration. I wonder if Columbia University would have ever invited Jerry Falwell to speak openly and candidly about his own views on their campus in the interests of tolerance and fair play and hearing the other side. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has pledged genocide on the nation of Israel. How is it that an institution like Columbia University can extend the right hand of fellowship to such a person and invite them as a distinguished speaker to address their school? Now, this tells you a lot about Columbia. I guess the defense that the professor gave the president of the university is, well, we have free speech. Listen, freedom doesn't imply a forum, you know. It doesn't require such a thing. You can have freedom to speak. It doesn't mean you have to give the person a forum to express that freedom. And when you give a person a forum like that, then you give him a certain type of legitimacy at the same time. But once again, tolerance is a one-way street. 1-800-227-5278, and in the 714 area code, if you're local to me here in Orange County in Southern California, 754-4150 is the local number. I'm Greg Kokel. This is Stand to Reason, and if you'd like to call me, I'd love to chat with you about anything that's on your mind in the era of ethics, values, and religion. Stay with us.
In 1859, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of the Species and argued that all of life on Earth was the product of time, chance, and natural selection. However, contemporary scientists are advancing a powerful but controversial idea, the theory of intelligent design. Using state-of-the-art computer animation, the Unlocking the Mystery of Life DVD transports you into the interior of the living cell to explore systems that bear the unmistakable hallmarks of design. This compelling documentary examines an idea with the power to revolutionize our understanding of life and to unlock the mystery of its origin. Unlocking the Mystery of Life. To order this riveting DVD, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON or str.org.
Does the Christian faith stand up to the scrutiny of critics? Tough scrutiny? How credible is the Bible, and how seriously should you take it? Can you entrust your eternity to its message? Based on Lee Strobel's provocative national TV program, the new DVD series, Faith Under Fire, features fascinating debates and riveting interviews with Christians, atheists, Muslims, and proponents of other faiths as they tackle today's hottest spiritual topics. Lee Strobel concludes each session by offering his own perspective. These two new DVDs, now available from Stand to Reason, include discussions on Is the Supernatural Real? Is Jesus a Prophet or the Son of God? Do All Roads Lead to God? Did Jesus Rise from the Dead? And more interesting topics. Guests include skeptic Michael Shermer, critics Edward Tabash, Richard Carrier, and Shabir Ali. Defenders of Christianity include Dr. J.P. Moreland, Dr. William Lade Craig, Greg Kokel, and Stephen Meyer. Contact Stand to Reason at str.org or 800-2-REASON to order these fascinating DVDs.
Just a poor boy, though my story is seldom told. Greg Kokel back with you here at Stand to Reason. And, I hate even to break in on this music. It's among my favorite here. Simon and Garfunkel, the early days, back in the 60s. These guys are probably the greatest lyricists that I have ever heard, close maybe to Lennon and McCartney, but not, but they're not as good as these two guys were in their heyday, and that would be the 60s. 1-800-227-5278. Of course, I don't know why I'm giving the number because our lines are completely full up. By the way, just one parting thought here on Kathy Griffin. You know, she holds the award, this thing, the Emmy, in the air and said, "This award is my God now." Do you feel just a sense of pity for someone who would actually believe such a thing? Now, this might have been overstatement, tongue-in-cheek, in your face, but anyone who would think, this is it, this is, I've arrived, I've got it, this is what grounds my life, it defines me, it gives me significance, this golden thing. Now I can live for the rest of my life off the accomplishments of my past. What an empty life. What an empty life. It's just, that's sad. Okay, in Omaha, Nebraska, John, welcome to Stand to Reason. Glad you called. Greg Kokel. Hi.
Hey, Greg, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
Good, good. I had always had a question about this issue, but it's been made all the more important by the fact that I now have a 9-month-old daughter.
Mm-hmm.
She's received a first Halloween card and some other Halloween-type stuff that looks all cutesy and everything.
She received a Halloween card? She's only 9 months old?
Yeah.
She can't read yet, can she?
No. They have, she's advanced, but not that bad. She's
spoken like a papa.
And other Christian friends are talking about what their kids want to be for Halloween and all this stuff just this past week and stuff. I was hearing this. And, you know, through the years, she's going to be having a lot of friends that have no problem with celebrating Halloween.
Right.
And Christian friends. And I know that doing whatever the majority does isn't a good way to measure truth or what we should do, but I was just wondering for myself, for my wife.
How do you approach that?
Child, what principles maybe I should...
Yeah, okay, well, there's a lot that could be said about this because I think that there's a lot of bad thinking by Christians who have a knee-jerk reaction to this kind of thing. So let me just offer some thoughts. Before I get going, though, I just want to mention that I think I've written on this and that you'll find something on our website at str.org. Just type in Halloween in the search box and then you'll have something there. I think Gretchen Passantino over at Answers in Action has written something too, and it's worth reading. I think I have both of those documents. I'm not sure if Gretchen's piece is posted on our site or not. But I think what we kind of represent is what might be considered a moderate or middle of the road approach. I don't think that Halloween is entirely benign, and I'll explain precisely why, because my reasons are going to be different than some other people's reasons, I think. But I also don't think that any participation at all is somehow complicity with the occult. And this is a mistake people make who don't have Christmas trees, for example. They say, you don't understand, December 25th wasn't when Jesus was born, and I don't know who anybody who's, you know, out of grade school who believes that Jesus was actually born on December 25th. This is a made-up date, okay, for celebration. They say December 25th is when the Saturnal was and the pagans used to worship this, some god, you know, and so it's God Saturn. So this is when we – and they used to – you know, they plant trees and there's a fertility thing going with the green tree and they decorate it. And this is all satanic. It's all demonic. It's all pagan. Well, what they were doing was pagan, and it might have been demonic in some sense, and in the from deep in the background, it may have been satanic. But that doesn't mean that somebody who honors Christ on the 25th of December, while somebody else is honoring the god to Saturn, is doing the same thing that they're doing, or someone who has a Christmas tree and gives gifts to reflect the gift that God gave us in Christ is actually participating in a pagan ceremony. The content is everything here. The intent is the content, I guess. And so what has happened is Christians have taken pagan practices and reinvested them with deep theological significance and meaning. And when they are so reinvested, they become something different. Even circumcision, which God commanded of the Jews in the Mosaic Covenant was something practiced for other purposes by the Egyptians before them. So I see nothing wrong with taking up certain types of forms and reinvesting them with different meaning than the original people had. So there might have been an occultic purpose for a pumpkin. You know, you've got they originally were four, and people will tell you what this is. I can't even remember now. Maybe I've written about this, but it slips my mind. But, you know, to scare away the demons or I don't know what. So they carve a face and then they put in a candle, whatever. But that isn't why I would carve a face into a pumpkin and put a candle in it. And if I did that, I'm not somehow mystically, magically inviting demons into my home because I've done this thing to a pumpkin. So I think those forms can be captured for something benign, mm-hmm. All right? And a lot of the things that have to do with Halloween, dressing up, going trick-or-treating, giving candy, those kinds of things, these in themselves are benign. And even if they might have had a history in something nefarious, practicing those things now in the way they do that does not make us complicit in that earlier nefarious enterprise. Are you with me so far?
Yeah.
Okay.
I just wondered.
Well, I'm not quite finished. I have more to say, but
okay, sorry, to
offer, there is an element that I am concerned with, but did you want to add something before I get into that?
No, go ahead.
Well, here is my concern. Now, I do have a concern about these things, but the concern isn't just that, you know, people would go trick-or-treating or have canterns, have jack-o'-lanterns or these kinds of things that might have had long ago some kind of a history or played a role in some occultic practice but clearly are not doing so now. That doesn't trouble me. That's the other extreme. However, it does trouble me that there are occultic themes that people are playing on. No, I mean explicitly, not implicitly. A jack-o'-lantern isn't an explicit occultic theme. If you knew something about the history, maybe. But when people are dressed up as goblins or witches or as ghosts or skeletons, or, I mean things like that, or Satan or something like that. My concern about that is this, and it's quite – there is a concern there, but it's different than many people have. And that is that people have taken what are genuine occultic realities – and they are, in a sense, making light and making fun of them to the degree that people no longer take these serious things serious. So if you said something about the devil, somebody might say, oh yeah, the devil, I know who he is. He's the guy in the red costume with the horns and the trident and all of that. Yeah, right. Tell me about the devil. So what sometimes these practices do is they cause us to take occultic realities less seriously than we ought. And that, I think, is a palpable damage. And so my recommendation is, and then I'd be very happy to hear from you, my recommendation is that we not run from Halloween because of some past association with the occult, or that even today some people practice Halloween and have some connection with occultic imagery, where they wear a witch's outfit or something, that we not contribute to the downside of that by celebrating or participating in this American holiday and wearing costumes that reflect occultic realities that we should be taking more seriously than the costumes seem to indicate. Many churches have something like, instead of going door to door, which some parents are concerned with for safety reasons anyway for their kids, traffic and strangers and whatever,
sure.
They take their kids to the church and they have a harvest celebration, which they play games and they get candy and it's a fun time. So they capture this night for some other purpose and they reinvent it in a sense, and I think that's a wonderful thing too. But I have had times when I just decided not to give candy at the door, and I think I missed out on a lot in doing that. So now my wife and I, this last year we didn't do it because our neighborhood is such that there's not a lot of trick-or-treaters. But in the past when we were in a neighborhood where that was happening, we would, you know, give candy and talk to the kids and just be friendly and be good neighbors about it because we didn't think that our participation at that level was in any wise spiritually suspect. But if our daughter, who is now 2.5 years old, we don't take her out trick-or-treating, We haven't yet, but if we were, we wouldn't take her out in a witch outfit. We might let her dress up as Cinderella or something like that. So you can kind of catch the way we're trying to apply these concepts. How's that sound to you?
I understand what you're saying. Yeah. I just had a question because something that you said there made me wonder. Was there a time when you thought differently about this issue?
Well, before I was a follower of Christ, I had no qualms about it whatsoever. After I became a follower of Christ, I think I had a little bit more of a knee-jerk reaction. Now I'm a Christian. I've got to say no to all of these things. And so it was like from one extreme to the other. And I think I've taken a more, and I'm going to call it a more nuanced position. In other words, I thought through this more, and I realized there are some things that we do that we can participate in our culture that even though they had a past history, don't have that history for us now, and therefore it's okay. Because the same, the extreme view that disqualifies much of Halloween in terms of it, even practicing it, also disqualifies much of Christmas.
Which, oh, I do realize that.
Yeah, so I don't think the reasoning is good applied to either. But there is a concern that I think it's appropriate to raise, and that is, well, you have these occult themes that are playing themselves out in some cases, and maybe that's not a good idea when that we're making fun or making light of something that's very serious and that people ought to take seriously. And so in that area, I say then don't do anything that could make light of that. And now I'll add one other thought here, John, and that is that some followers of Christ, believers, are not going to be persuaded by what I just said, and they're still going to feel that their personal involvement of any kind in Halloween night is just wrong. And for those people, I have one bit of advice. Follow your conscience. Paul makes it very clear. Sometimes people have conscience problems with this, and they should do what they think is best under those circumstances. Now, he makes it clear when he says this that they may be mistaken in the assessment they're making of the morality of the thing in question, but since their conscience is sensitive about it, he doesn't want them to injure their conscience. And so if you think it's wrong, then don't do it. It's not a relativism that he's promoting here. He is just simply saying, okay, I think we lost John. Did we?
No, I'm here.
Oh, okay. If it's not a relativism being promoted there, but he is saying don't injure your conscience. And so if others disagree with me, then it's best to follow your conscience and not to follow Coca-Cola on this one. Does that make sense, John?
Sure, yes. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I appreciate your call, and I hope, and you know, this will probably come up, you know, more than once in the next couple of weeks as we move closer to All Saints Day, which that date also is. It's not? Okay. Well, I'm getting corrected by the former Lutheran here because she knows about all these things. By the way, this is the enforcer, and her birthday is on October 31st, so she knows all about this day. Okay, let me see what it says. Reformation Day, November 1st is All Saints Day. Oh, sorry about that. You're right. So, a Reformation Day, because it was October 31st that the 99 Theses were posted to the church door in Worms by Martin Luther, which started the Reformation. So lots of good reasons to celebrate on that day, not the least of being the enforcer's birthday. What did I say? It's the Wittenberg door. What did I say? I said the... All right, don't pay any attention to me. I've got just a little bit of low blood sugar right now. It was on the Wittenberg door on October 31st. Was it 1517? All right. Those are good reasons to celebrate, and you might just celebrate because your community is involved in this. Just don't celebrate the occult, okay? That's my short answer. STR.org is the place to find the commentary that I've written on this. Let's go to is it time to go to break? Already. Oh, boy, how time flies. Okay, let's go to break, and we'll come back to your calls right here on Stand to Reason.
We are ambassadors for Christ. That's what Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:20. An effective ambassador has three essential skills. First, an ambassador must have the basic knowledge necessary for his task. Second, this knowledge must be deployed in a skillful way. There's an element of wisdom, a tactical and artful diplomacy that makes his message persuasive. Third is character. His personal maturity and individual virtue will either make or break his message. Stand to Reason's mission is to help you develop the foundational skills in each one of these areas. In Essential Ambassador Skills, Greg Kokel will train you in all three of these areas to be an effective ambassador for Christ and to represent God's message of grace in a broken world. To order this unique message, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. 800-2-REASON or str.org to order Essential Ambassador Skills by Greg Kokel. I have a suggestion for you. Pick up the phone and dial 1-800-2-REASON. That's Stand to Reason's toll-free number. Ask us to send you solid ground, then leave your name and address. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. If you call us, we're going to send you our bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, free for a year. This is no ordinary newsletter. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ. In Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will help you deal with issues like abortion, evolution, cloning, homosexuality, doctor-assisted suicide, something timely so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador on key issues you will be challenged on. So call us right now at 1-800-2-REASON and ask for Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free. Or go to our website at str.org and ask for Solid Ground. While you're at it, you can download some of the over 300 free reports you'll also find there. That's 1-800-2-REASON and on the web, str.org.
A public service announcement followed me home the other day. I paid it, never mind.
Greg Kokel back with you here at Stand to Reason, standing for classical Christianity and classical Christian values. And just to straighten out the debacle of the end of the last segment here, it was Martin Luther on October 31st, 1517, that nailed the 99 Theses to the door of the church in Wittenberg. That is the Wittenberg door. What did I say? 99? Gosh, the 95 Theses. Oh, it was Agent 99. Ah, see, I'm getting Martin Luther mixed up with Maxwell Smart here. Oh, that explains it. Okay. Maybe I should just quit while I'm this far behind, right? It's cut my losses. All right, I think I'll do that. But I will tell you one thing that I know for sure, that 2 years ago, October 31st is when my little girl took her first steps towards Papa. So that's actually not just a triple holiday, if you figure Halloween, All Saints Day. I mean, Reformation. Never mind. Let's go to callers. All right. Lancaster and Ed, rescue me from this segment, would you please?
I could hope to.
You're listening to the best of Stand to Reason.
How did that happen? Where did that come from?
That wasn't me.
It wasn't me either. Okay, go ahead, Ed.
A few weeks ago, you talked to Dr. Beckwith about his move back to Catholicism.
Yes.
And one point in the argument or the discussion where you two had a disagreement has been kind of weighing on me ever since. And that was he claimed that you needed to show why the Catholic Church did not have the authority. And, of course, you pointed out that the church had to prove that it did have the authority.
Yes, this is. I'm glad you brought this up because I would like to spend a few moments to clarify that point of the argument. Here was my argument. I mean, obviously there's a number of big differences between Roman Catholics and Protestants, and there are two, in my view, that are the most central.
Right.
One is the issue of justification, which we pursued just a bit, but not enough to my satisfaction. I think that was clear to everybody. And secondly, the issue of authority, which we pursued just a bit. The question of authority, to me, almost is the more important one than justification. Principally because the views about justification that Roman Catholic Church holds is tied somewhat to their authority claim to have the right to claim to say what the Bible means in certain matters. So
right.
This is principle
right.
In terms of the order of knowing. Okay, so the debate then between Roman Catholics and Protestants has been about sola scriptura, which is the idea of Bible only. And here, of course, Bible only means that only the Bible has the divine authority of God to speak to us on these matters. And no other human institution has the same authority as the Bible. That's
right.
Kind of a way of putting it.
Right.
I argued in a way that I haven't heard anybody argue yet, but I think it's probably the simplest and cleanest way for us to argue. And I said, I believe the Bible is the inspired word of God. And so do Roman Catholics. So on my claim, we both agree. But Roman Catholics add an additional claim. They say that not only is the Bible inspired, but so is Holy Tradition, so is the teaching magisterium of the Roman Catholic Church, and so is the Pope when he speaks from the chair or ex cathedra, which has only happened a couple of times, or maybe only once, I think. But in any event, they have also this kind of authority. Since the Catholics and Protestants agree on the Protestant source of authority, no controversy there, and they add three new sources of authority or additional ones, then they are the only ones who have a case to make, and the burden of proof is upon them. Dr. Bethwick disagreed on two counts. He said, first of all, in principle, since by the time of the Reformation, the Roman Catholic claims to authority had been well established, it was the reformers that were asking for a change of view, and therefore they had the burden to prove that the status quo wasn't correct, and the burden was on them. And then he also raised objection to my argument, saying, if your way of arguing is legitimate, then the person with the lesser claim always has the privileged position, and the person with the more advanced claim or more involved claim has the larger burden. And so the person who argued for fewer books of the Bible would be in a better position than the person who argued for more books of the Bible. Now, we didn't pursue those points much further than that, but I have two observations to make. Even though Dr. Beckwith is right, this is status quo at the time of the 15th century or 16th century when the Reformation formally started, was the Roman Catholic Church's authority and its claims, it still doesn't, simply in virtue of it being the status quo, doesn't make it legitimate. It still has to stand on its own feet and verify and justify the claims that it makes to speak for God. And when any prophet or apostle or Jesus himself spoke for God, each was, and especially Jesus, was willing to give evidence that their claim of authority was legitimate, authentic, and verified. In fact,
that was the main reason why I called.
Yes.
Point that out.
Yes, and so I don't buy the fact that just because they're kind of the reformers and the new kids on the block that they somehow bear this burden. The fact is, and back to the other illustration, that somebody who has fewer books of the Bible then would be in a better position who claims more books of the Bible. I guess I'd have to say, yeah, that's exactly right. If you and I, Ed, both believe that the book of Hebrews was inspired, but you also believe that the book of Romans was inspired and I didn't, well, then it would fall to you to demonstrate why Romans is inspired, and it wouldn't fall to me to demonstrate anything, because the claim that I'm making is something we agree on. So there's no reason for me to prove anything because you would agree with my claim, and I think the same thing applies here.
Well, it's pretty much a case of looking at the credentials. You know, if say, an FBI agent showed up at your door saying something, you'd want, all right, let me see your credentials.
Uh-huh.
And when we have someone claiming to speak for God, we can say the same thing. What are your credentials to speak for him?
Yes, I think
so
you're absolutely right.
With Moses, he said, well, how am I going to know, or how are they going to know that I'm speaking for you?
Right.
So God said, all right, what do you have in your hand?
Right.
Staff.
Uh-huh.
Turned into a snake.
Right.
Stick your hand in your bosom, turned into leprosy.
Right.
Yeah, and even, you know, if that doesn't work, go to the Nile, pull out some water and dump it on the floor and it'll turn to blood.
Right, and then all the 10 plagues followed. And that is an excellent point, that God was willing to give evidence
right.
to and substantiate the authority claim of Moses in this particular case in the Exodus.
And even the famous case where the guy was lowered through the roof and Jesus first told him, your sins are forgiven.
Right.
And the priest said, what authority do you have? And Jesus
mm-hmm.
said, so that you know that I have authority, take up your bed and walk.
Yes, uh-huh.
Now, I was also thinking that...
That's Mark chapter 2.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Luke...
There's a parallel passage. See, the point you're making is really good. Even Jesus himself, when he made these claims to speak for God, he was willing to give palpable evidence to people that he was actually speaking accurately. They could trust him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when anybody makes such a claim, then the burden of proof is upon them. And just because Rome may not have carried that burden or satisfied that burden for 1,500 years or 1,000 years or whatever it is, since their ascendancy up until the time of the Reformation and Martin Luther, doesn't mean that they are somehow now have a privileged position and they don't have to answer that challenge. I think they still have to do that.
Yeah, I believe so, too.
Yeah, and I haven't seen anything to my satisfaction at all to demonstrate that they actually have given us evidence that they do speak for God. I mean, how would anybody know, for example, that the Pope, when he speaks under the special conditions that would allow him to speak infallibly, that he's actually speaking infallibly under those circumstances? Who says so? I mean, obviously, the Pope has been wrong all kinds of times in the past. You have the anti-popes that are excommunicating each other, for goodness sake. So where is the test? Jesus in the book of John gave all kinds of signs, and not just the miracles, but he said, look at my witnesses. Moses is a witness. The Father is a witness. The Holy Spirit is a witness. John is a witness. My works are a witness. Look at all these witnesses,
mm-hmm.
Not just my own claim. But these are all witnesses to me, witnesses of me to you, that I am who I claim to be and have the authority. So where does Rome, how does Rome substantiate such a claim? And I'll tell you what, they're not going to get it out of Matthew 16, where Jesus allegedly identified Peter as the rock upon whom he will build his church. Because even if we took the Roman Catholic interpretation of that verse, it still doesn't follow all of their authority claims.
I was thinking, I don't know of any examples where God imbued an office with authority. He only imbued individuals.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a good point. Examples where there's prophets and judges, but those were cases where the office was empty unless God specifically filled it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, kings or even the high priest, you know, even though God may have set up those offices, that didn't necessarily mean...
Well, the high priest, as far as I know, never had authority. Not the kind of authority that revelatory authority to guide the church. They just fulfilled the functions that were given them,
exactly.
That God had laid out. They were following the instructions, but they weren't rulers of the people in the sense that giving God's directives to the people. That certainly wasn't the case of the high priest. So,
exactly.
Yeah, this is a very...
Also, as apologists, too. We also have to explain to people why we think the Bible has authority.
Yeah.
And again, we have to look at the credentials even for the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, historically accurate. And now this is where I kind of need a little input from you on other reasons why we consider the canon to actually be, you know, have the credentials, such as, well, I know for the Torah, you know, Moses had authority. He had the signs and miracles that proved that he really was speaking for God.
Right.
And therefore what he wrote is also carries that same authority.
Right.
Now for the rest of the Bible, there's some, but I'm a little weaker on...
Well, it isn't like every single line of the Bible has, or even every individual book has with it invested an individual authority given to it where each writer proves his right to speak for God. It's not as tidy as that. What part of my confidence with regards to the canon has to do with God's superintending of the entire enterprise. I have a talk called Has God Spoken, and it sounds like you might be familiar with that. And in that talk, I give reasons why I think we are justified in saying that the Bible, taken as a whole, is a book that is not principally a result of man's ideas given to men or man's ideas about God, but really a book from God to man, which is the same thing that it claims for itself. And I give six stamps of the supernatural. In other words, there's evidence of God's involvement there. Now, if the argument itself is compelling or if it works, part of what's packaged into the notion of inspired scripture is the notion of canon. That is, which particular scriptures are those that are the inspired ones. That is, God is going to preserve his work and somehow give a testimony or a witness to the rest of through his church about the legitimacy and authority of those works that he has put his stamp of approval on. And so you can
–
pardon me?
In other words, the credentials.
The credentials. And so even though I can't say, well, James, how do I know James independently, or this verse in James is one that God put his credential? Well, it's not the verse, it's the book, and it's the book in virtue of the role of James in the apostolic band would be one way of arguing. And the apostles were the ones who established canon rule for the church, and after they died, it was their writings that established canon rule for the church. It wasn't subsequent apostles that had spoke with the same authority. So you kind of take the work as a whole, as it were. Now, there is some debate as to some of these books that should be in the canon, but just to make the point, the books that are part of the Apocrypha that the Roman Catholic Church considers additional to what we would consider were not officially canonized until the Council of Trent. That's when they were placed in, and it seems like, to me, obviously a political move in a response to the Reformation that took exception with certain doctrines that they found support for in these other books. These scriptures that they identify as part of their Bible that are not part of your Bible were never considered by the Jews themselves as part of God's Word, and these are Jewish documents. So I think it's safe to go back to look and see how Israel dealt with their people as with their texts, they as the people of God at the time. And they didn't accept these things as canon, so there's no reason, I don't think, for us to. But that's part of the debate between the two groups. Okay, I'm going to have to move, Ed, to another caller. I appreciate your call, and it'll probably stimulate some more questions by others. Let's go to Kihei. Oh, Kihei, Hawaii, on the island of Maui. Hello, John.
John. Hey, Craig, this is John. Hi.
Hey, John, what church do you go to in Kihei?
I go to Hope Chapel.
Oh, that's Craig Englert's church.
Yes, it is. I just heard him. We just did a 27th anniversary today.
Well, that's great.
Got an old picture of you that popped up on a
I'm sure it did.
Church.
Well, Craig discipled me many, many, many years ago, and so I'm glad to hear from somebody from his congregation. So what's on your mind today, John? We're right at the end of the hour. I want to make sure you get your question in.
Thank you very much. I'm in dialogue with what he calls himself, a rationalist. He's an objectivist, and he and I are in conversation right now on the definition of faith. He has a definition of faith as a belief in something that there is no evidence. And I'm trying to argue from, you know, Hebrews, I think it's 11:1 or it's 1:11. And it looks to me like there's two definitions of faith in that. But I just want to kind of get your take. I mean,
Let me give you a short way out of this, John. People can define words any way they want. If he wants to define faith as a leap against evidence, then when he uses that word, that's what he means. Now, we know what he has in mind when he uses the word faith. However, when we talk about faith biblically and as Christians, he is not free to insert his definition into our conversation. He has got to be satisfied with our definition if he's going to treat us charitably in a conversation. What he can't do is he can't take exception with our view by inserting his definition. When the Bible calls for faith, it's clear that this is an act of reasonable trust. It is not a leap of faith; it's a step of trust. It is a step that is based upon reasons and evidence. Now, if your friend John wants to insist that faith is irrational, well, then he's welcome to that definition when he talks about his own acts of faith. He is not welcome to define for the Bible a word that the Bible uses in a completely different way. This is just irresponsible. Do you see the point that I'm making?
I do.
And so what you want to do is demonstrate that when the Bible calls for pisteo, what it means there, that's the Greek word, is it's calling for active trust, and it is willing to give reasons for the step of trust. And indeed, the New Testament and Old Testament are filled with such evidences and reasons. Now, the evidences may not compel your friend. That's not important at this point. What matters is that when the Bible uses this word that is translated in the English to faith, it means something in particular. It means that it is inviting us to put our trust in God's provision for the reasons that the Bible gives. Notice at the end of the Gospel of John, chapter 20, the first couple verses, I think, or maybe it's the last couple verses of chapter 20. Anyway, right there at the end of John, John writes, "There are many other signs and miracles that Jesus performed that I haven't included here, but I've written these things in order that you may pisteo, believe." and that Jesus is the Son of God, and in believing have life in his name. So there is a very clear example at the end of the Gospel of John where John clarifies that his appeal to our his appeal to our trust is based on reasons. So it is not a blind leap.
Okay.
And what your friend has to show is that the Bible's appeal is a blind leap, not that he just wants to define faith as a blind leap. Does that make sense? Okay, John, I got to run. Listen,
Thank you very much.
John, give my best, please, to the Englerts and everybody else I know over there in Kihei. It's really great to hear from.
I just got to give a shout-out to Kit Lauer, my apologist friend.
Okay, take care now. Hour number two just ahead on Stand to Reason. Please don't go away. French cow is le mu. The British cow goes mu. I say mu. The Italian cow goes mwah, mwah. Looking for reliable information on current issues like safety. All right, that was embarrassing. I didn't know that my mic was on when I did that many years ago, but it's like with the internet and now with radio, it's like when you say it, it's there forever, right? Greg Koch will stand to reason hour number two, and thank you for joining me. Wherever you may happen to be, and we've opened up some new markets of late in Michigan, and I think in Kentucky and Ohio coming up before too long. Glad to hear that. Well, you're all welcome to participate in our show. 1-800-227-5278 is the number. And this is Stand to Reason. We call it the Marketplace of Ideas. Where issues of philosophy and religion can be discussed in the forum of Open Talk Radio. And some of you might be thinking, wait a minute, philosophy and religion? Like, I thought Paul said, beware of philosophy. No, he said, beware of philosophy of men. Don't be taken captive by it. That is, it was the philosophical ideas that originated from men. It's not the tools of philosophy that are the problem. It is the ideas of philosophers that are the problem. And if you have the tools of philosophy, which I have been trained in with under J.P. Moreland at Talbot University, and other instructors there too, have a master's degree in philosophy from that school. If you've been trained in it, then you can use the tools to help refute the bad ideas of many philosophers. So it's a great advantage to me as a person who takes thinking seriously and who thinks that Christianity is worth thinking about to bring not only theological tools to the table but also philosophical tools to help come to a clearer picture on what is actually true and right and good. And that's what this program has been now for almost 18 years now. We're just completing here in the next couple months our 18th year broadcasting from these studios here in Southern California at KBRT. And in the last, you know, 6 or 7 years have had this great advantage of the World Wide Web to send our broadcast through podcast all over the world. And now we get calls from all over the world and many around the country in places where our broadcast is not even heard. And we have some more of those coming up. In fact, we have a rare call coming up in a few minutes that's actually within our broadcast footprint here in five counties in Southern California. So if you're listening for the first time, we're just glad you're on board. And we hope that you continue to listen. And I'd like to let you know that we do have podcasts at our website, str.org. And you can go to str.org and then punch up the radio button there and just follow the prompts, and we'll send this show directly to your doorstep through your internet if you'd like that. So 2 hours a week, it's not burdensome to listen to, and you'll get quite an education. Before we go to our callers, I want to offer a thought that has to do with Bible study and Bible preaching and Bible analysis. Our goal here at Stand to Reason is not to tell you what to think. Well, sometimes we want to tell you what to think. But we want to give you our reasons for it so you learn not just what to think, but also how to think as well. And this is particularly true about theological notions. It's important how you come to the conclusions that you come to. It's not just important that you come to the right conclusion. It's important how you come to those conclusions, because if you come to the conclusions in the wrong way, even if they're the right conclusions, it shows you got lucky. We don't want you to be lucky. We want you to believe the right things for the right reasons. And therefore, we want to train you to think more carefully about those things that really matter. And this brings me to just some quick reflections on how pastors deal with scriptures. And I've made an observation over the last couple of years that is a little troublesome to me. And I don't want to lay this at the door of any particular pastor. I think pastors are socialized to do this, and I think Christians do it all the time in general, too, partly because it's been modeled from the pulpit for them. And they think this is right. I have talked in the past about my concern about topical teachings. The concern is that even though you can go through the Bible and isolate the information about a certain topic, and indeed that's what theology a lot of times entails, just isolating systematically isolating the information about a certain aspect that the Bible teaches on, like man or the Holy Spirit or God proper or the cross or whatever. And so you have the doctrine of anthropology and soteriology and eschatology and theology and pneumatology, the spirit, and things like that. These are all kind of topical studies, and so they have their place. But frequently what happens with topicals today is pastors are jumping around in text trying to find something that will titillate their audience. So let's find a self-help idea, and let's jump around passages and find information that we might form into a topical that would make your life better. Now, there's nothing wrong with making your life better, but it seems to me the goal that we have when we go as pastors to the text for our congregation is not to make our congregation's life better, but is to teach them what the text teaches and let the text, through the Holy Spirit, do the work it God intended it to do. Now, I think it's going to, in a sense, make your life better, in a sense, but it's going to do it on its own terms. In other words, God's going to use his word on his own terms to accomplish that goal. We don't have to kind of slice and dice it and repackage it and make something new. I'll tell you one of the problems of doing it this way, and the problem is, one problem is that you never learn the reason why God gave a text in the first place if you're only getting bits and pieces of it coupled with other bits and pieces of other texts to formulate a kind of an artificial teaching of the text. For example, I was talking with somebody about the notion of hearing the voice of God, and he cited the passage, "My sheep hear my voice." And he was citing the passage against something I was teaching. He thought this was a text that contradicted my notions. And I asked him, as I often do when somebody proof texts against my view, where is the verse? In this case, he knew where it was. It was in John 10. So I asked my second question. Tell me what's going on in John 10. Now, friends, if you cite a passage and you don't have any sense of what's going on in the greater context of the passage you cite, you can't have the confidence that you're citing it accurately. And here was the answer that he gave me. He cited a verse from John 10, "My sheep hear my voice," and that is there. And when I asked him what is going on in John 10, he said, "Jesus is giving a talk on principles of leadership." Actually, I think he said 10 principles of leadership. Now, I had to suppress a laugh. I didn't want to be rude, but this Jesus was talking about nothing of the kind. Now, I suspect what he had heard is he'd gone to a leadership seminar and somebody had extracted from John 10 10 leadership's principles. I mean, this is the place where Jesus said the shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. Now, is that a good leadership principle? Yeah, I guess it is. But Jesus wasn't talking about leaders. He was talking about himself. He was the good shepherd who laid his life down for his sheep. That was the point there. This wasn't about leadership. It was about Jesus. And indeed, in John 10, there was nothing about leadership being taught. Jesus' intention wasn't to teach about leadership. There was a horrendous conflict that he was having with the Jewish leaders about himself. And these words, "My sheep hear my voice," are embedded in that more lengthy discussion. Now, the point I'm making is this person, through listening to a topical, had never learned. He might have learned some good things about leadership, presumably, through the talk that he listened to based on John 10. But he never learned what Jesus was trying to get across there in the first place. Why did John himself include this whole chapter and all that information? It wasn't to teach about leadership. And this is the point. It's not our job to try to slice and dice and find clever things to make little talks so that we can give them something they need. We think that would be useful to them. It's our job to teach the text and then let the text be useful for the purposes God intended. I guess that's my point. Because something else begins to happen when we start to try to artificially make the text useful. What happens is we make metaphors out of the text. And the metaphors aren't really what I suspect the author had in mind to begin with. Here's a classic example of what I'm talking about. You read in the Gospels about Jesus calming the sea. He's in the boat with his disciples. They're going across the Sea of Galilee. A great gale comes up. They are petrified with fear. Jesus is asleep in the bow of the boat. Doesn't bother him. Finally, they say, "Jesus, don't you care that we're perishing?" And he gets up and he rebukes the storm, and the storm becomes calm. And so here's the passage. We read it in church, and then the pastor has an application. And all of you know exactly what the pastor's teaching will be at this point. He is going to ask the audience a question. And the question is going to be something like this. I know it's ringing in your mind even as I speak. What are the storms in your life? What chaos are you now experiencing? What is the raging sea that Jesus can make calm? Because he can do it. Now, can Jesus make storms in your life calm? Can he take chaos and redeem it for peace and serenity? Of course he can. That's not the question. The question is, what is going on in this passage? And the temptation is great to take passages like that and to make them into metaphors. Now, this is not what the gospel writer intended you to understand from the passage when he placed that account in his document, his rendering of Jesus' life. You know, they don't include everything. They only include certain things. They include the things that make the point they want to make as they are guided by the Spirit to write the gospel. So what was the point? The point wasn't to see how Jesus could calm your lives. How do I know this? Because when Jesus was finished, the disciples didn't say, "Golly gee, he calmed the storm." "Hey, Simon, what kind of storms are going on in your life that Jesus can begin to calm? Hey, Peter, I know that you kind of went through some rough times. What storms did he calm in your life?" Gee, because Jesus is the storm calmer in our lives. No, they didn't do that. What did they do? We know what they did. It's recorded in the text. They fell on their face and they worshiped Jesus. You see, the gospel writer didn't include this in the account in order to tell us about how Jesus can fix our lives. He included it in the account because the account is not about our lives. The gospels are about Jesus. It told us something about Jesus. It told us that Jesus is a human being who can control the forces of nature. The proper application of that is not to say, "Wow, if he can control the force of nature, he can control the incidents of my life." That's not the point. The point is, if he can control the force of nature, he must really be something. Yeah, like God. Which is why they fell on their face and they worshiped him. They were terrified by what he had just done. It told them something about Jesus. Now, that's the right application. Now, you can go from there. And maybe you might want to say, gee, if he's God and he can control the storms, maybe he can control the storms in your life as a secondary element, but you don't want to miss the main point. Now, this happens all the time, and it happens not just in the New Testament, the Old Testament, and this is why people frequently take Old Testament promises made to other people and apply them to themselves. I don't know why someone would feel justified in doing that. I know they've been socialized to do it. Everybody does it. It's second nature. I know the plans that I have for you, saith the Lord, to give you a future and a hope. There, I like that verse. That's for me. Jeremiah 29. But that wasn't a promise to us. That was a promise to them. Those who were in the captivity in Babylon. In fact, it was part of a letter written to the elders. So why would we want to take a promise explicitly for someone else and claim it for ourselves? I mean, I don't see the justification for that, but it's a habit that we get into. So the lesson here is to be careful. When you go back to the text, try to study the text and ask the question, what is the point the author is trying to make with this account, if it's a narrative? Or what is the point the author is making in the teaching, if it's an epistle? If it's Old Testament, you have to ask, what does this say about Israel and its relationship to other nations and Israel's relationship to God? You see, the Old Testament is about Israel. Now, there are things for us in there, but we can't get at them directly. We have to get at them indirectly through Israel, so we can't just export it wholesale into our lives without making some adjustments. That's true of most of the Old Testament, certainly the narrative portions. Because most of what the Old Testament is talking about, again, is not talking about us. It's talking about God and Israel, and ultimately it's talking about God. And so we have to be careful there. Goal is to get the point the author is making. Let's go to our phones now. And in Huntington Beach, Robert, and you're just down the street from us, Robert, and one of the few people I talk to nowadays who is actually listening in our broadcast footprint. We have so many people outside of it now calling in. Welcome to the show, Robert.
Thank you very much, Greg. Excellent job as always. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
In following with your comments about, you know, making sure, I know in the past you've talked about don't read a Bible verse. Of course, we're supposed to
never read a Bible verse. Right. If you want to know what the verse means, you have to read a paragraph or more.
That's right.
Exactly right.
I've got a question here. Heard a sermon this morning referencing Luke chapter 17, verses 7 through 10. And the reason why this particular passage is important to me is because I had someone very dear to me. She was fired from her church position. She was secretary to church. And she was fired, and part of you know, when she talks to me about you know, some of the things that she was very disappointed in is just, you know, just the lack of acknowledgement of the good job that she's done. She never really received thank yous, and there were some other deeper issues, of course. And the way that she was let go was pretty bad. I mean, it was like, okay, pick up your keys, let's go. I'm going to follow you around, pick up your belongings, out the door.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this morning when I heard this passage,
I've actually known some employers like that myself, so.
Pretty bad, don't you think?
Yeah, it's pretty draconian, it sounds like
to
me.
So I hear the pastor talking about this. He says, you know, we don't have a sense of entitlement. It's not good for us to say that that's not fair. I deserve this. Well, I think there's truth to that, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
But the one part about this verse, specifically when it comes to verse 9, where it says, well, maybe I should read it in context, it's really short. Which of you having a slave plowing or tending sheep will say to him, when he has come in from the field, come immediately and sit down to eat? But will he not say, prepare something for me to eat and properly clothe yourself and serve me while I eat and drink, and afterward you may eat and drink?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the master gets served first and then the slave.
Yeah, he doesn't thank the slave because he did the things which he was supposed to do, is the point that's made in verse 9.
Sure. Key verse in 9. He does not thank, that is the master, does not thank the slave because he did the things which we were commanded, which were commanded rather.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, does that mean that you know, we shouldn't be say thank you even though we're a pastor or a boss of someone, that we shouldn't acknowledge?
Right, right. Okay, let me see if I can make some sense of this. And I don't think it's really that tricky, but I can see how this would raise some questions about some things. With regards to the question about giving thanks and being appreciative and those kinds of things, do we have any other instructions in Scripture or principles that we see in play that might, in a sense, gainsay or disagree with this notion, or at least the take on this passage that maybe the pastor was taking. He said, look, Jesus said, you don't get thanks, you just do what you're supposed to do, so there you go. Is this kind of the unified voice of the Bible on this particular point? And it seems to me it's not. It seems to the idea of giving thanks and the idea of being gracious and kind to each other and encouraging one another and those kinds of things is spoken of many times in the Scriptures. So if we were to understand this passage to mean that we are really have no obligation or there's no propriety or necessity to be thankful to people who are doing their job that they're getting paid for or any of those kinds of gracious acts of charity or thankfulness, then we'd be at odds if we were to understand that this way. Then we'd be at odds with other passages that seem to say the opposite. Okay, are you with me so far?
Absolutely.
Okay, so then the question is, well, doesn't seem like he's giving a principle for living here. There's something else going on. And I think there is here. And now I haven't looked closely at the passage for a while. And sometimes when you have these passages like this that are, you know, Jesus in the Gospels, you have chunks of things kind of just set side by side. So he's talking about stumbling blocks in the beginning of chapter 17 and seven times seven. Forgiveness, that doesn't seem to relate to what follows here. But it does seem in verse 5 where it says, the apostle said to the Lord, increase our faith. And he said, if you had faith like a mustard seed, you'd say to this mulberry tree, be uprooted, be planted in the sea, and it would obey you. But which of you having a slave plowing or tending a sheep? And then the passage that you read.
Right.
So there's a tie-in here somehow, and I'm not entirely sure what it is. But I think I have a sense of what Jesus is getting at here. At least to some degree, and it's actually an idea that was developed very thoroughly by St. Anselm about 1,000 years after Jesus said this. And he was thinking about the issue of salvation and the claim that people make that, well, I'm good enough to get into heaven or my good deeds outweigh my bad deeds. And this, I think, this parable comes directly to play on that. I have to go to break now, but when I come back, I will tell you what I think is going on here, at least one sense of application of it, and we can move from there. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason. Don't go away.
In 1859, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of the Species and argued that all of life on Earth was the product of time, chance, and natural selection. However, contemporary scientists are advancing a powerful but controversial idea, the theory of intelligent design. Using state-of-the-art computer animation, the Unlocking the Mystery of Life DVD transports you into the interior of the living cell to explore systems that bear the unmistakable hallmarks of design. This compelling documentary examines an idea with the power to revolutionize our understanding of life and to unlock the mystery of its origin. Unlocking the Mystery of Life. To order this riveting DVD, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON or str.org.
Does the Christian faith stand up to the scrutiny of critics? Tough scrutiny? How credible is the Bible, and how seriously should you take it? Can you entrust your eternity to its message? Based on Lee Strobel's provocative national TV program, the new DVD series, Faith Under Fire, features fascinating debates and riveting interviews with Christians, atheists, Muslims, and proponents of other faiths as they tackle today's hottest spiritual topics. Lee Strobel concludes each session by offering his own perspective. These two new DVDs, now available from Stand to Reason, include discussions on, is the supernatural real? Is Jesus a prophet or the Son of God? Do all roads lead to God? Did Jesus rise from the dead? And more interesting topics. Guests include skeptic Michael Shermer, critics Edward Tabash, Richard Carrier, and Shabir Ali. Defenders of Christianity include Dr. J.P. Moreland, Dr. William Lade Craig, Greg Kokel, and Stephen Meyer. Contact Stand to Reason at str.org or 800-2-REASON to order these fascinating DVDs.
Stand to Reason, the place to get a well-furnished mind, ladies and gentlemen. Sundays 3 to 5 here on the West Coast, and wherever else you're listening, you can make the time adjustment. Glad to have you all on board. My congratulations to Jordan, and I'm going to say Stivey, or maybe Stevie, or Stuvey. That would be S-T-U-I-V-E. Jordan Stuvey, who's the Frapper winner for this week. And, of course, if you're listening to the show and you go to our website and the place where the podcast is listed, so you can sign up for the podcast, you can also identify yourself as a listener and put a pin in the map, as it were, the Frapper map there. And if you identify yourself as part of our listening community out there, then we will put your name in a drawing every week for a free gift. And Jordan, you're the one. Now, we need some help from you, Jordan, because for some reason we don't have your address. So we'd love to send you a free gift, but we need to know where you live. So give us a call or send us an email. That would be Jordan, Stevie, S-T-U-I-V-E, and congratulations to you. I haven't mentioned, by the way, for a while, and I'm going to be doing this more regularly, but I want to remind you of our cruise coming up to Alaska starting on the 2nd of August in 2008. So you got almost a year to plan for it. We're going to be gone for about a week, August 2nd through 9th. We're going to set sail from Vancouver, British Columbia, aboard Holland America's MS Staten Dam, and we have sailed with them before. We've had a great experience with Holland America, and we'll be doing it again. If you were on our last cruise, this is going to be a little different. We're not leaving from Seattle, but we're leaving from Vancouver, and we have in our lineup for the cities or the itinerary, we'll be, of course, at Glacier Bay. We'll be at Juneau and Ketchikan, of course, but we'll also be at Skagway. And we've never gone to Skagway before. That's the gold rush town. And we're spending an entire day, like first thing in the morning to late at night, before we disembark from or we embark from that particular port. So this is a great lineup. But it's not, of course, just an opportunity to go to Alaska. It's a chance to go to Alaska with us, with Stand to Reason, and our guest speakers. And the lineup is going to be J.P. Moreland, who has had more influence in my life than any other teacher. He's going to be our guest speaker, one of the most popular, and also the father-son team of Josh and Sean McDowell. And we're all looking forward to a tremendous time of teaching with Josh McDowell, Sean McDowell, J.P. Moreland, and I'll be there, of course, doing some instruction myself. Not only will they be giving talks, but there'll be open forum times where we have discussions and you can ask your questions of the speakers directly. And, of course, we'll all be on the same ship together for a whole week at meals and sightseeing and the like. We'd love to have you a part of that. If you want to go to our website, I think there's a link right from str.org, or you can simply dial up 1-800-247-1899. That's 247-1899, and you can register with Inspiration Cruises and Tours. They'll send you more information. We do have a brochure. Is this brochure going out in our next mailing? In November, okay? So September, October, November. With our November Solid Ground, you will be receiving our Stand to Reason Alaska Cruise information for 2008, and we'd love to have you on board, quite literally on board. Let's go back to Robert in Huntington Beach. And Robert, we're talking about a passage out of chapter 17 of the book of Luke.
Yes.
And when the slave does his job and Jesus said, okay, you did your job, then you don't get any special thanks for that. And kind of an unfortunate application of this passage that was made in a church that you're aware of, where a woman who worked really hard was given no thanks, just given her paycheck. And that seems cold. And this seemed to be the proof text. I'll tell you one of the things I think is going on here. And I mentioned that St. Anselm developed this idea with regards to the person who says, well, my good deeds will outweigh my bad deeds. Now, the point that I make here, and this is something that Anselm made in a very sublime way in his, I can't remember the name of the piece, but Acerdus Homo, I think, Why the God-Man.
Acerdus Homo, yeah.
Yeah, Why the God-Man. And he said, look, when you do a good thing for God, you have done what you are supposed to do. That is, if you owe God all your allegiance and all your goodness, when you don't give him your goodness, you incur a debt. But when you do subsequent good things, you are doing only what you are supposed to have been doing all along, so you don't gain any extra to pay the debt off, so to speak.
I see.
You can't get ahead of the game because you are always expected to do what's right. You can't do something over and above what you should have done to pay for the times you fell short. and therefore no one can save himself, is the point that he's making. Now, I think this is the same point that Jesus is making here.
Yeah.
Notice in verse 10, he says, he kind of gives his application. So you too, when you do all the things which are commanded you, say, we are unworthy slaves. We have done only that which we ought to have done. And there's a mystery a little bit about this parable for me. I mean, there's probably a lot of things I'm missing here. And I don't actually see the connection of this verse 7 through 10, which is the bulk of this parable, and what comes before it, verse 5 and 6, where Jesus is talking about faith like a mustard seed. Somebody maybe smarter than me can see the connection. It does seem to be part of the same, what they call a pericope, or kind of grouping of sentences or paragraphs. So it seems to be related, but I'm not sure why. But the meaning of this passage does seem to be clear to me, that this is talking about when we do everything that we are supposed to be doing. This doesn't gain us merit. It just brings us equal, or even, in a sense, with our obligation. It's kind of like, I've put it in a kind of a joking way, when you keep the laws of the country perfectly, you don't get a letter from the district attorney saying, hey, I notice you haven't broken any laws recently. That's great. Good for you. Go out and knock off a couple of gas stations on us. You have credit in your account. Doesn't work that way. And I think that's part of what's going on here. Now, I don't think that any justification, though, for treating other human beings in an ingracious way when they work for us, even if they're getting paid for their work. And I think there are other texts that indicate that showing courtesy and grace to the people who work with us is an appropriate thing to do. I don't think the right application of this text is the way the church happened to apply it. All right?
Thank you very much, Greg. Have a good day.
I appreciate the call, Robert. And I think it is kind of a tough passage, but we're doing our best to at least get the meaning correct here. Let's go to Mark, and that would be Mark in Shreve, Ohio. Mark, hey. Welcome to the show. Hi.
Yeah. Hi, Greg. How are you doing?
Doing good, thanks.
All right. Hey, question. Today at church, we had it was like a different than normal service. It was Kids Day, the baby pictures, all that stuff. And Pastor preached a short sermon, and he started off the sermon. It was about loving your kids, and before he, or just in the beginning when he was starting, he made a disclaimer. He said, this is a pastor's paraphrase. And he quoted 2 Corinthians 5:20 and said, we are Christ's parents instead of Christ's ambassadors. And, there's blended families in the church, and I myself have a blended family.
Uh-huh.
There were some points well taken, but listening to your comment at the beginning of this hour,
mm-hmm.
I would say my pastor is more of a topical kind of a guy.
Yeah, yeah, and they're dangerous to topical. I mean, in one sense, I do topicals. This is what we do as an organization, but I'm not one's pastor who is to give steady teaching from the Word. I might talk about homosexuality. I might talk about, abortion or whatever. So we do topicals. I'm not totally against it. But for steady training from the Word, I think we have to take the text the way it was given, and instead of just trying to jump from verse to verse. And this passage here, chapter 5, verse 20 in 2 Corinthians, is a passage we're well familiar with because it's really part of one of the theme verses of Stand to Reason.
Well, I'm taking the ABC.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
Yeah,
just for those who are...
That's probably why it hit me so hard, too. And
right.
I just don't know. I mean, I don't know how serious or... I mean,
Well, we have to show charity to pastors and these kind of things and kind of let a lot of things slide, or else we're going to be, complaining about them all the time. So that's one thing we want to guard against. But let me speak to this issue, this particular passage and what was done with it. 2 Corinthians 5:20 says, therefore, we are ambassadors for Christ. As though God were entreating through us, we beg of you on behalf of Christ, be reconciled to God. And the word reconciled appears about four or five times in different forms in those five verses.
Okay.
So we know that this passage is about the process or the issue of reconciliation between God and man, and that there are people placed between God and men in general who are to facilitate the process of reconciliation. Paul identifies them as ambassadors, and those are the ones who are followers of Christ. And so that's a very important lesson there. Now, to say this is a pastor's paraphrase, and then not paraphrase the passage at all, but to distort the passage radically and say, we are parents of Christ, to me, is a big mistake. Now, I have nothing against paraphrases, as long as the paraphrases are meant to capture the meaning in a crisper way. Pastors do this all the time. Good teachers. John MacArthur is a good example of this. He'll exegete the passage, and then based on the meaning that he gets from the text that he think is the intent of the author, he will then give his paraphrase. And that's a good idea. But the paraphrase has to line up with the scholarship. And the paraphrase is not meant to change the meaning to make a different point than the text it actually makes. That's a mistake. I think that's an abuse of the passage. Now, I wasn't there, and so I can't tell you, well, what was his point of saying that we are parents for Christ? He might have been meaning that we are ambassadors for Christ as parents to our children. So when we are parents for Christ, that means that as parents, we are the ambassadors that are meant to reach our children. Now, if that's what he meant, then I'm not troubled by that, because part of the role of an ambassador is experienced in different, more formal roles in our life. So we are all ambassadors for Christ, but when you're working down at the plant, you know, you're an ambassador for Christ as a worker. When you're having recreation somewhere, you're an ambassador for Christ there. Or when you're a parent, you are an ambassador for Christ to your children in your role as a parent. Now, I don't have any trouble with that, and that might be what he meant.
Okay.
Do you think I'm on the mark here, or you were there, I wasn't?
I think, yeah, I was trying to give him the benefit of the doubt. I don't think he was real clear on that, but, you know, I was thinking, I was hoping that that's what he was talking about.
Yeah, okay, well, let's just be charitable, and we'll give him the benefit of the doubt that maybe in an awkward way or a less than clear way, this is what he was actually getting at. And so in that case, then, he is making application in a way that I think is appropriate. So if if we're ambassadors for Christ, that means in every circumstance we are representing the Lord. Whether we're representing the Lord, like I said, out at our job, or whether we're representing the Lord as a parent to our children or husbands to our wives or whatever, we are still the Lord's representative, and that ought to inform how we behave. And I think that is a fine application. And notice that this is kind of a paraphrase of the material, but it's capturing, I think, the sense of the passage. Make sense?
That makes sense, yeah.
Okay. Good talking to you, Mark. I appreciate your call. Let's go to a blue – we got to go to break already? Do you want to go to break? Where are we going? To break? And then we'll come back to Blue Springs, Missouri, and John, and then Oxnard, California in just a moment. I'm Greg Kokel at Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
We are ambassadors for Christ. That's what Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:20. An effective ambassador has three essential skills. First, an ambassador must have the basic knowledge necessary for his task. Second, this knowledge must be deployed in a skillful way. There's an element of wisdom, a tactical and artful diplomacy that makes his message persuasive. Third is character. His personal maturity and individual virtue will either make or break his message. Stand to Reason's mission is to help you develop the foundational skills in each one of these areas. In Essential Ambassador Skills, Greg Kokel will train you in all three of these areas to be an effective ambassador for Christ and to represent God's message of grace in a broken world. To order this unique message, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. 800-2-REASON or str.org to order Essential Ambassador Skills by Greg Kokel.
I have a suggestion for you. Pick up the phone and dial 1-800-2-REASON. That's Stand to Reason's toll-free number. Ask us to send you solid ground, then leave your name and address. It's that simple.
Let me tell you what this is for. If you call us, we're going to send you our bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, free for a year. This is no ordinary newsletter. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ. In Solid Ground, Greg Kochel will help you deal with issues like abortion, evolution, cloning, homosexuality, doctor-assisted suicide, something timely so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador on key issues you will be challenged on. So call us right now at 1-800-2-REASON and ask for Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free. Or go to our website at str.org and ask for Solid Ground. While you're at it, you can download some of the over 300 free reports you'll also find there. That's 1-800-2-REASON and on the web, str.org.
Greg Kochel here, giving you a piece of my mind today, as I do every Sunday afternoon or early evening, depending on where you're listening from or from where you're listening. It's a little more elegant. No preposition at the end, right? And let's go quickly here in our last segment right to the phones because we have some interesting calls coming up. John in Blue Springs, Missouri. Hello, John.
Hello, Greg. How are you?
Doing good. How are you?
I'm just fine.
Missouri is the home, the original home of Bass Pro Shops. You probably knew that, Springfield.
In Springfield, Missouri, that's right.
I was at the Bass Pro Shops out here in Los Angeles area for the first time. I took my daughter on an outing, and she knows Bass Pro Shops. She can't read, but she knows when she sees that symbol. And they've got 185,000 square feet out here, and I thought this was big for a shop, and they said the one in Springfield is over 300,000 square feet, so that's massive.
Can you believe it?
Unbelievable. That's like Nirvana, right?
Yeah, they even put the boats and everything else in the shelves.
Yeah, it's great.
Keep them outside.
So you didn't call, though, about Bass Pro Shops, I'm sure. I just had to say that about Missouri.
But I will say this. I'm jealous because they ended up getting a Bass Pro out in Southern California before they got one close to the Kansas City area.
Oh, I see. That's the problem. Okay. Well, it's a long drive for me. It took me more than an hour to get there. So, Southern California is big. It's a big place, but what's on your mind today, John?
Yeah, Mr. Kochel, before I try to pick your mind, can I tell you real quick how I heard about you?
Yeah, you can do that.
My wife bought me a iPod for Christmas.
Uh-huh.
And I went and started looking at things to download, and I was actually reading a book by John Ortberg, and I found that Lead Like Jesus seminar.
Uh-huh.
And I grabbed that and ended up catching your speech on that. And then I Googled you and went and found your podcast and everything else. And, of course, since then I found about Stand to Reason and everything.
Well, that's wonderful. I can't remember what I said about Ortberg in that seminar, but that's beside the point today. I'm glad through whatever means you were able to find our show and found it valuable and useful.
It was actually your debate that you talked about on pluralism.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But at any rate, when I was listening to one of the broadcasts here a while back, you had mentioned, I believe, that you're a Calvinist.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really, really surprised to hear that.
Why would that be?
Well,
I'm too smart to be a Calvinist? Is that what you're thinking?
No.
It's just a joke. Well, sorry.
Well, yeah. And I guess the reason that I was surprised is that I thought that Calvinism kind of removed free will from the picture.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess my question, if I should pose this in a question, is does Calvinism remove, the tenet or the doctrine of free will?
Yeah, okay, well, this is good. I'm glad we're having this conversation. I'm not going to be able to cover all the bases, in our short conversation here, but I can give you some things to think about. Let me ask a question.
Sure.
Do you sin? This is going to be a couple of short, easy ones. Do you sin?
Oh, gosh.
That's an easy one.
Of course. Yeah.
Okay, yes. Now, do you sin freely?
Yes.
Okay. Could you not sin?
In
your present state of affairs.
In my present, okay.
You're not the resurrection.
If it's the will of God, anything could happen. But my present state of affairs, no.
No. So you cannot not sin. Now, why can you not sin?
Because we've been born into a sinful world.
Okay. Now I want you to think. I agree with all of those things you said. Now, I just want you to think about them, though. You said, I sin.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I sin freely. Mm-hmm. I cannot not sin because I was born a sinner.
Right.
Well, if you cannot not sin, how could you be sinning freely? Now, I appreciate the pause there because you realize, well, there's something odd going on there, because generally we think of a free act as an act. Well, an act is free if we could have done otherwise. We could have done differently. I can pick up this glass or not. I can walk from this room or not. Now, if I'm tied to the chair, I'm not free. Even if I wanted to sit here, I couldn't have done otherwise, so my action of sitting here is not a free action.
Okay. Can I ask you a question now?
Well, I'm trying to lay a little, I don't mind answering questions, but I want to lay a little foundation here of thinking. The reason I ask these questions here, and I've raised this issue, is because there are actually two different ways of thinking about freedom.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is an act isn't free unless you could have done otherwise. That's called libertarian freedom. Okay. Another one is an act is free as long as you do it. It's your decision.
Okay.
Now, the first sense of freedom, libertarian freedom, is maybe true of a lot of our actions, that we have a lot of things that we seem to could have done otherwise, and so a lot of our acts are free. But we know that the Bible holds us responsible for our sin, and we are culpable before God because we are choosing freely to do so, but we realize that the freedom that we're exercising in that case is different than the one we were just talking about. Because we realize that the reason that we do this, we couldn't have done otherwise. We're going to sin because we're born into sin, but the sins are still ours. And it seems that we're responsible for them, and this is why God can properly judge us. But we're free in a different sense there. There is a sense in which the outcome or the reality of sinfulness in our life is predetermined because we're sinners. But it's because our wills are bent towards sin, and we choose that. We choose with our wills, that's what we want, and we want to sin, and we're held responsible for that. It's because of this biblical distinction here that I think we see in play between these two senses of freedom that I think work in our lives that I hold to a Reformed view of salvation. I think that nobody can turn to God on his own, unaided by God, because his will is bent against God, and he wills not to obey God. He wills from this bent will, this will inclined towards rebellion, to rebel against God. And if that is not dealt with, then no one will ever be saved. However, God has, in his graciousness and mercy, exercised that grace to incline the will of some people back towards him so that they then respond to their newly inclined will and then choose him and ask for forgiveness and follow him. And so just as they were freely sinning consistent with their inclined will against God, now they are freely choosing him consistent with their inclined will towards him. It's still a legitimate choice. It's a free choice, I would argue, but a free choice based on the second definition, not a free choice based on the first, because when God inclines our wills toward him, it is not the case that we could have done otherwise even there. In neither case could we have done otherwise on our own steam. Either we're inclined against him as a result of the fall and follow our evil inclination in rebellion, or he inclines us towards us and we follow our good inclination now and we surrender to him. And that guarantees, of course, our position before him in Christ in salvation. That's classically called election in the Calvinistic understanding of the term.
Mm-hmm.
And now I think those things are clearly taught in the Scriptures, and therefore this is why I hold the view that I hold. But it is not an issue of whether you have free will or not. It's what your understanding of free will actually entails. And I think the sense of free will that I'm using to describe the work of God sovereignly in our lives is a sense that we are all aware of, because even when I question you initially about our sinning and freedom, this is a sense of freedom that you also acknowledged even in the questioning.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that is a legitimate understanding of how freedom works, and I do think the Bible actually teaches that is the way things work with regards to salvation, even if it turns out that there are other decisions we might make in our lives that are decisions that reflect a libertarian free will. Now, your question. Does that make sense, first of all?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. And I'm sitting here pausing because you've given me a tremendous amount of information in a very short
time. I appreciate that, and I apologize for that. It's just the way radio works.
Because this is good, and I actually need to understand the tenets of Calvinism or any other aspect or theological stance of our faith before I really speak about it, and I do try to understand.
Right, and I think this is R.C. Sproul has written about these kinds of things in a way that's accessible to the rank and file. Michael Horton has done. James White has done so as well. James White at Alpha and Omega Ministries. But I think that when people kind of out and about who haven't been exposed very much to more careful thinking about some of these things hear about it, they have your response. Well, I thought, like, if you're an Arminian, you believe in free will, and if you're a Calvinist, you don't. And this actually isn't accurate, and it's a result of uninformed Calvinists and uninformed Arminians that are talking about this issue in an inaccurate way.
Well, and when you mentioned that you were a Calvinist, and my former opinion about Calvinism is that it takes away the issue of free will, the way that you just re-explained that it doesn't actually take away free will, because we're kind of because God chooses whose person's will he will bend toward.
Right. That's called election or sovereign grace, right.
Called election or sovereign grace. Then you say that opens up the opportunity for that person to
turn to God.
Yeah, turn to
God. It doesn't just open. I'm going to have to end with this thought because I got another call to get to, and maybe in the future we can talk more about it because it raises a lot of issues. But it doesn't just open the opportunity. It secures the end. It guarantees the end. So all those that God works on in this way, it doesn't bring them up even. It takes them into the kingdom. So in one sense, you are never really free. You're either a slave to sin, or you're a slave to God. And this is the message of Romans 6, by the way. Anyway, think about that, John. I've said a lot.
Sure.
Listen to the podcast, and then call me back. We'll talk some more in a couple of weeks, okay?
Hey, thank you so much for your ministry, Greg. I really enjoy it.
You're welcome. All the best. Let's go to Oxnard, California, and Sammy. Hey, Sammy. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, I'm sorry. We're a little tight on time here, but go ahead. I wanted to get you in before the end.
Yes. My question is, are you considered a Christian if you don't go to church?
Well, you may not be considered a Christian by other Christians, but you don't have to go to church if what you mean is a service on Sunday morning in order to be a Christian. The Bible never teaches us to go to church in the sense that we normally think about it. It says that we should not forsake the assembling of ourselves together. And that's in Hebrews chapter 10. The rule of Sabbath is not kept by Christians nowadays anyway, even if some people think they are. Sabbath is on Saturday. It's sundown to sundown, Friday to Saturday. What we do is different. We celebrate together, characteristically, on Sunday, the first day of the week, not the last day of the week. That's a very different kind of thing. So it isn't like we're keeping the commandment in the Ten Commandments to honor the Sabbath, because we don't do that. We do something different in Christendom. And the New Testament doesn't repeat that command as something incumbent upon us. And in fact, the New Testament Christians' practice was different anyway. It says that we should assemble ourselves together. But even if you don't assemble yourselves together, you can still be a Christian. You just might not be a very obedient one or a very mature one.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Is your church, somebody at your church is telling you if you don't go to church on Sunday, then you're...
No, for years and years and years, I attended the Protestant church. And always felt that, you know, it just really struggled to go. I didn't enjoy it, didn't like the services, and would try different churches to see if there was something out there that I liked. And my husband and I, by accident, went to an Orthodox church, a Christian Orthodox church, in which I really liked the service.
Uh-huh.
And the more I studied Christian history, really felt that, you know, this is close to what the...
Is this like a Greek Orthodox or Russian Orthodox or...
Actually, this would be an OCA church, Orthodox Church of America.
Okay.
And
is that like Antiochian? Okay.
And we've gone to the Russian church and we've enjoyed those.
Okay. So this is something that resonates with you as a follower of Christ in that kind of atmosphere. Okay. Are you being accused? Go ahead.
But even with that, it's like lately I just absolutely positively am dragging my heels. I haven't gone to church in 6 weeks, and I was always one of those Christians that said, if you don't go to church regularly every single Sunday, you really can't call yourself a Christian because you're not really living the faith.
Yeah, I don't agree with that.
I'm eating my words because I feel like the last few weeks my family and I have grown closer because we're spending that day together and doing fun things together as a family, and I'm really dreading just the services.
Sammy, let me jump in for a second. Again, I want to be sensitive to time here. And I think that spending the day together with your family and getting closer is certainly a virtue, all right? But the purpose of church is not to get closer as a family. Mm-hmm. That may be the result in some cases, and certainly is true in our case, but my wife and I, for example, but it is not the purpose. The purpose is to assemble together with other like-minded people to be trained, to be instructed, to be exhorted, to be built up and encouraged, all of these kinds of things. Now, if it turns out that you are sitting in the seat and those things aren't happening, you're wasting your time. And it sounds like this was the way it was for you and a lot of other Protestant churches. And there's no virtue to kind of punching your clock and sitting through a bunch of stuff that annoys you or bores you. You're not doing God a favor. The church is meant to serve a biblical function. And if it serving that function, then you got to find some way to fulfill the function in some other manner. And so spending the time with your family may be really great, and I don't want to begrudge you that, but maybe it's a better way of spending your Sunday afternoons, but you still have to find a way to meet the need of being with other like-minded Christians in which you can receive encouragement and comfort and exhortation and teaching from the Scripture. And that might be a weekly Bible study for you. Maybe your church is going to be Wednesday afternoon or evening or something. I don't know. And I'm fully open to that. And I know there's been a custom to meeting together on Sunday mornings, and that this custom sometimes holds people captive so that they fulfill the custom and they never fulfill the purpose that God intended that what has become a custom to do in their lives.
Well, I think that was one of the things that really turned me off going to church.
Yeah.
So
my recommendation is that you...
And really quick, I know you only have a second.
Okay.
The Orthodox Christian Church, what are your views on that?
Well, I don't know much about the OCA? I don't know much about them. Most of the Orthodox churches take the position. I think their view is that they are the Church of Jesus Christ. It's a similar kind of claim that the Roman Catholic Church makes, but they made a break at right around 1000,
right,
and on the filioque, it was on a very, very refined point of doctrine, it seems to me, that most people wouldn't even understand. It had to do with how the Holy Spirit was generated from the Father and the Son.
Right, and it also with papal supremacy that the Orthodox Christian Church does not
disagree. Obviously, yes, that's correct, but they also believe that they're the, and I actually think there's an inherent problem to all of these kinds of claims. These all assume that Jesus came to start an organization. I see nothing in the Scriptures that show that Jesus came to start an organization as opposed to an organism. He came to build his church, but the church isn't like that organization that has these kind of bishops and whatever. The church is the organic body of Christ, the believers over the whole world, and it was not meant to be centrally organized. I don't get any sense of that from the New Testament. Even when the apostles went out and started churches and they appointed elders, there was no sense that they had to be part of this larger structure. So in that sense, I am suspicious of any claims of groups, Orthodox, Roman Catholic, whatever, that identifies their organization as the authoritative organization that Jesus came to found. That was just off the top of my head, Sammy. I couldn't give you more. We're out of time. But thank you for your call. And call us back. We'll chat some more about those issues. Greg Kochel on Stand to Reason saying have a good week. Be good ambassadors for Christ and see you next time. Bye-bye now.